Welcome to Peace Journalism Perspectives, a program produced by the Center for Global Peace Journalism at Park University. Here's your host, the author of Peace Journalism Principles and Practices, Stephen Youngblood.
Welcome to the inaugural program of Peace Journalism Perspectives. My name is Steve Youngblood, and as mentioned, I'm the director of the Center for Global Peace Journalism at Park University here in the Kansas City area. On today's program, we'll begin by taking a look at what exactly is peace journalism, sort of a peace journalism 101. Then we'll take a look at media and peace journalism, particularly as it relates to the rhetoric of the 2016 election. Then finally today, we'll have updates from the most recent Peace Journalist magazine. We'll take a look at refugees as journalists, and we'll have a report about reconciliation from South Sudan. We begin today with Chapter 1, What is Peace Journalism? Now, since this program is obviously titled Peace Journalism Perspectives, I thought we could spend a minute or two and I could put on my professor's hat, and we could talk a bit about what exactly is peace journalism. So by definition, peace journalism is when reporters and editors make choices that can create an atmosphere that's conducive to peace. So what choices am I talking about? I'm talking about word choice. So that's extremely important in peace journalism. So are we using simple words or are we using inflammatory words? Are we using words that describe the situation without pouring gasoline on the fire? That's an analogy I like to use frequently. Another choice that we make as journalists is how we frame our stories. So are we telling the story in such a way that it at least presents peaceful and nonviolent perspectives? Or instead, are we telling our stories in such a way that, again, we're pouring gasoline on the fire, that we're taking a bad situation and making it even worse? So one of the examples that I always give, and one of the examples that's outlined in my book, is the way that the media covered Ferguson, Baltimore, and most recently Charlotte. So did the ways that the media covered that civic unrest, did that coverage help to create an environment where people could honestly talk about these racial issues, or instead did it simply merely stoke more racial hatred? I hate to use that word hatred, but I think there's some truth to that. So in peace journalism then, what we're looking to do is to work with journalists, work with academics, and to improve the quality of the journalism being practiced around the world. I've had the opportunity to work with journalists from many different countries, about 30 countries, I would say. And the one common denominator seems to be that we all in the journalism profession recognize the need to be better reporters and to do a better job completely representing our communities. This summer, for example, I was in Germany and Austria talking about reporting refugees and the ways that German and Austrian media can improve refugee reporting. In a few minutes later on this program, we'll talk about how these peace journalism principles can be applied to the reporting that occurred during this year and the last year about the 2016 presidential election. Above all else, peace journalism is about simply not taking a bad situation and making it worse. It's an awareness that our reporting has consequences. It's an awareness that what we do and how we do it can have a substantial influence on the public, on public opinion, on societal cohesiveness. Keeping all this in mind, in 2012, we launched the Center for Global Peace Journalism at Park University. So what the center does is it works with journalists, academics, and students around the world to improve reporting about conflicts, about social unrest, to improve reporting about reconciliation, solutions, and even peace. Through our courses, our workshops, and our lectures, through our magazine called The Peace Journalist, we'll look inside those pages in a few minutes, through our blog, through our other resources, the Center for Global Peace Journalism encourages media to reject sensational reporting, inflammatory reporting, and to produce counter-narratives that offer a more nuanced view of those who are marginalized by societies, ethnic and racial and religious minorities, women, youth, and even migrants and refugees. So that's a bit of an overview of peace journalism, what it is, and the Center for Global Peace Journalism. Coming up on Peace Journalism Perspectives, a look at how peace journalism can apply to coverage of the 2016 election.
You're listening to Peace Journalism Perspectives on KKFI, Kansas City, 90.1 FM.
Chapter 2, Park University, Johnson County Community College, and the Center for Global Peace Journalism recently sponsored their fourth annual peacebuilding conference. The theme this year was peacebuilding, redefining us versus them. The first day of the conference was held Friday, November 4th at Park University and featured a presentation on inclusion by Park University President Dr. Greg Gunderson. The second day of the conference was the following day, Saturday, November 5th, and it was held at Johnson County Community College. The day's events at Johnson County Community College included a presentation on peace journalism and the rhetoric of the 2016 election. The panel discussion was led by myself and included my special guests, Mara Williams, a reporter and columnist at the Kansas City Star, and JCCC political science professor Marie Paxton. One of the most lively topics of discussion during the panel was about the idea of false equivalency. That is, are we treating the candidates, should we treat the candidates, the same? Here's an excerpt from that discussion. Should you give an equivalency to their candidacies? And a lot has been written and said lately about this idea of a false equivalent. So a false equivalence is what happens when you're led to believe that two things should be given equal weight as you make journalistic decisions, even though they are not actually equivalent. Take this principle then and apply it to electoral coverage. Should the media give proportional, even-handed coverage to the two candidates, even though they have dramatically different records and temperaments? So one of my favorite columnists at the New York Times, his name is Nicholas Kristof, wrote a piece about a month ago that talked about this idea of false equivalence. And it started with this polling data. A CNN ORC poll found that by a margin of 15 points, voters thought Donald Trump was more honest and trustworthy than Hillary Clinton. Let's be frank. Now, this is according to Nicholas Kristof. The public perception is completely at odds with the evidence. So PolitiFact, which is a nonpartisan fact-checking organization, did a study, that's the word I'm looking for, where they took Trump's statements and they took Hillary's statements. And what they found with Hillary's statements, that about 13%, so remember that number, 13% were rated false or pants on fire. Okay. And they found that that 13% rate is sort of typical for a politician. All right? So they all lie. She lies at about a typical rate for a politician. Donald Trump was found lying 53% of the time, more than half of the time. So what we have is a 4-to-1 ratio. Even someone math challenged like me can do that. 4-to-1 ratio. So in a moment, I'm going to ask our panelists, does that mean that we have, for every one article about Hillary's dishonesty, should we have 4 articles about Trump's dishonesty? Hold on to that thought, I'll get you in a minute. Another angle, is there a false equivalency, or should there be an equivalency between Trump's sex scandals and Hillary's WikiLeaks? All I can tell you is this, that a recent study shows that, as you can guess, the sex stuff has gotten much more coverage. From October 7th to 13th, the morning and evening news shows on ABC, CBS, and NBC dedicated 4 hours and 13 minutes to Trump's sex scandals. During that same period, WikiLeaks got only 36 minutes of coverage. So are you telling me, press, that the sex scandals are 7 or 8 or 9 times more important than the WikiLeaks? So what do you think?
Are the sex scandals more important than the WikiLeaks? Well, the general public seems to think it is. meaning that you have to ask the question, are we determining what is more important, or does the general, and then we feed and give that to the general public, or does the general public tell us what's more important, or what they want to hear, or what they want to read, or what they want to see, and then we continue to feed them that because we are starving for viewership.
But as we were discussing before the session, doesn't responsible press have doesn't good press have a responsibility to lead and not just feed people what they want?
Absolutely. Good press has a responsibility to lead, and I think good press still does that. However, what is media today is not what media was 20 years ago, meaning that it's a much broader platform. You have social media and Twitter and Facebook and bloggers, and so there's all those people don't have the same limitations as, let's say, a New York Times or a Kansas City Star, for that matter. And so they are out there feeding the general public for clicks, for viewership, and getting that. And we are left going, oh, God, we need those eyes too. So what do we do? So, I mean, it's so much more complicated than what is the most important thing. What do we think people need to hear, and what do we want to give the general audience?
Well, hasn't it always been a juggling act between, I mean, we know we could sell a lot more newspapers, a lot more, get more viewers for our TV programs if we had more sensational, more salacious content. For example, I don't remember which newspaper in the UK, you can tell me, but on page 3 or 4, every day in this newspaper, there's a beautiful, barely dressed woman. Which newspaper?
The Sun.
The Sun. They still do that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So how many people buy The Sun because there's a beautiful woman on page 3? And so, but I know we would agree that that's not journalism.
No.
So I mean, where do you draw that line?
You attempt to balance. Now, something I wanted to bring up when you were talking about, equal time. The FCC still enforces the equal time rule. So, and that is that if a radio or TV network gives one candidate airtime, they have to give the opposing candidate equal airtime. That rule still exists. We still follow that. If I write about something about Donald Trump, I also have to include Hillary in there in some way. So maybe that's how we get this perpetuance of false equivalence, because you have to take what they're presenting and present that, but you have to give equal time.
And Professor, I'm going to get you in just a moment, but that brings me to my first question in this segment, which is, I've got candidate A who lies 4 times more than candidate B. Is it merely satisfactory to have, here's an article about this liar and here's an article about that liar, even though they're statistically not equivalent?
Yes. I wanted to ask this question.
See, panelist. Throw it back at the moderator.
Yeah. You know, here's my question, is when you look at the two candidates and you think about their experience as politicians or not a politician, you have to ask the question, too, does Donald Trump lie because he believes the lie he's saying and he's just ignorant about what the facts are, and Hillary, because of her experience, is she knowingly lying? So which lie is worse then? If you knowingly lie you ought to know better, and you tell a lie just because you just don't know better. I think that the media's responsibility, or real journalists' responsibility, is to, when one lie is presented, to then also present the fact and to fact check their lies. And I think that's how we have to be analytical, as we can't just put out the information, we have to also be analytical. And I think that is what media has been trying to do. I mean, there's all kinds of, if you read some of these stories, you'll see the lie and say, but in reality, this is what's happening. And I think that is our responsibility.
Professor, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a false equivalency.
Why?
Four lies versus one, it's I do think that, yeah, there seems to be this kind of attempt to report in a balanced way that makes WikiLeaks scandals look the same as the sex scandals, for instance. But I struggle with the disclaimer, and I also kind of struggle with the media acting as a sort of moral policeman. I'm worried that whilst I do think there is a certain responsibility to present things as they are, I think that that's to a certain extent impossible. There's always going to be the subjectivity, the power relations, all of that of the journalist. So I worry that by doing that, do we come to some kind of slippery slope of making decisions about which is worse? I don't know if that should be in the hands of the journalist, or whether that's something to present the facts, like you say, then move on to policies and leave that up to the general public to work out which is worse. I mean, isn't that democracy, kind of leaving people to come to these conclusions about which scandal trumps the other, you know?
Trumps. So, I guess the counter argument to that would be, if journalism isn't leading these discussions, then who is? Then who should?
Well, I think it's about being kind of more balanced and more kind of impartial about that reporting, so that there's less rhetoric clouding those facts, so that the public are getting more of a pure sense of what's going on, rather than kind of having to sift through and work out what is each scandal actually about.
Has the reporting been unbalanced?
I think it's been balanced, but I think that it has not been impartial.
That was from the conference Peacebuilding, Redefining Us Versus Them, on November 5th at Johnson County Community College, featuring the Kansas City Star's Mara Williams, JCCC's Marie Paxton, and yours truly, Stephen Youngblood.
This is 90.1 KKFI Kansas City, and you're tuned to Peace Journalism Perspectives.
Chapter 3. The Center for Global Peace Journalism at Park University publishes a semi-annual magazine called The Peace Journalist. In the current issue of The Peace Journalist, which, by the way, can be found at park.edu/peacecenter, all one word, in the latest edition of The Peace Journalist, we have articles from Afghanistan, from Liberia, from Mozambique, from Macedonia, basically from all around the world. Several of the most interesting pieces have to do with refugees, and particularly the idea that with the current turmoil in the Middle East and elsewhere, that journalists themselves have become refugees. On page 5 of the magazine, there's an article called Journalist as Refugee, The Flight to Uganda. So it talks about the fact that there are 21.3 million people worldwide who are refugees, according to UNHCR. Interestingly, there's no database that tracks the exact number of journalists worldwide who are refugees. The reason, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, is the extreme difficulty of getting information that's comprehensive, or at least reflecting global trends in this area. Still, the CPJ works diligently to assist refugee reporters. So in a 2015 report at the cpj.org website, it talks about how CPJ has helped over 100 Syrian refugees go into exile. Of course, while the world's attention is turned to Syria, there are refugee crises in many other places. One such place is South Sudan. And in the pages of the Peace Journalist magazine are some dispatches from a former journalist in South Sudan who's been forced, for his own safety and the safety of his family, to flee to Uganda. This is one small excerpt of an email that he sent to journalist colleagues in the U.S. He said, "Today, when I presented my family members to be reunited with me to get refugee status, people working in the office of the deputy camp commandant are demanding money. I truly do not know how other journalists from this country or Ugandans can come in to help the situation. In fact, it has now become worse in this refugee camp since the first day I arrived. What I saw, I would not be able to explain all the things that are here. Other South Sudanese have even made their way back to South Sudan, promising to go and die in their country rather than being undermined in this country." So there's much more from our journalist refugee colleague in the Peace Journalist magazine. A related item in the Peace Journalist magazine talks about a recent workshop in South Sudan conducted by the Center for Global Peace Journalism here in Parkville, Missouri, and the Peace Journalism Foundation of East Africa, headquartered in Kampala. In this particular peace journalism seminar, journalists from throughout South Sudan were gathered in Juba, the capital, to talk about, particularly about, reconciliation and the power of media to assist the reconciliation process. During our seminar, one of the things we asked our reporter participants to do was to go into the field and file radio reports about the reconciliation process in South Sudan, specifically to look for peacemakers who were looking to build bridges across communities. Other reporters did stories based on the theme of forgiveness and reconciliation, and that indeed was the story that I filed. The introduction to the story goes like this. A power-sharing agreement has brought peace, at least for the time being, to war-torn South Sudan. Former rebel leader Riek Machar has been sworn in as vice president and will share power, along with President Salva Kiir. The power-sharing agreement is sparking hopes of a successful unity government and an end to the violence, which has, according to UN statistics, displaced 2 million, created food insecurity for 5.3 million more, and claimed up to 50,000 lives. As South Sudanese ponder what peace might mean, they are also considering if reconciliation is even possible. I spoke with one South Sudanese survivor and optimist.
Like many of his South Sudanese countrymen, Mabang Kerr has made two journeys during the Civil War. The first, a journey of bravery and survival, and the second, a journey of reconciliation and forgiveness. For Mabang Kerr, the war began in December 2013 with news that ethnic violence had flared in his region called Jonglei.
Rumors are going on here that explanation that Nuer may come and attack people in Bor. When I get that information that one was killed with his brother, it was really, I haven't settled. I was not settling. So I know that there is a big problem ahead of me.
Upon hearing the news, Kerr tried to convince his mother and sister to leave immediately. But mom said no, they shouldn't go until they hear gunfire. A smart tactic, according to Kerr. So they waited until the next day. When Kerr spotted popular hangouts half empty and people fleeing with their possessions, including bags of sorghum on their heads, he knew the time had come to evacuate.
But my mom, I refused to go away with my sister. She told me that, no, I cannot leave you, because me, I'm last born. So I cannot leave you unless I die. So I was running. I ran up to the place.
Kerr, his mom, and sister fled their home near the Jonglei city of Bor and hid in the bush for 7 days with no food. Then Kerr spotted his opportunity to cross the river and evacuate his mom and sister downstream to Juba. The problem? The only way to get to a small boat was to wade through forehead-high water.
So I moved to the river where the water is at this level because the boat is like this and I have to move to the other side where that I can get access to enter there. So what I do, the water was there, and just like I begin with the little sister, I carry her on my neck, and I drove her to the boat. Then I also go back and carry mom, and I throw her into the boat. So remaining me now, as I hear that they are coming.
Had Kerr not evacuated, he has no doubts as to his fate and the fate of his family.
I don't think I will not be living in this world, because that time it was terrible.
Human Rights Watch said that the December 2013 attacks featured targeted killings of civilians in Bor. Although they couldn't give an estimate of the fatalities, Human Rights Watch did cite an incident where 14 women seeking refuge in a church were killed. Kerr also didn't have an estimate on the deaths during the attack in Jonglei, but believes it must have been in the hundreds, if not 1,000. Once they escaped, Bor and his family made it safely to Juba, but relocated back to Bor once the fighting abated. And Kerr eventually landed his dream job at a radio station. For Kerr and thousands like him, their second journey is just beginning. This journey surely isn't as perilous, but may even be more difficult. The journey to somehow reconcile with those who killed neighbors and friends. When he's discussing reconciliation and forgiveness, Mabankur is a different man, broadly smiling and effervescent. His face said, "I forgive," before he ever moved his lips.
For me, really, I don't have problem. I know what have happened, but we are living together. Even some of them, they are playing in the team there in Jonglei State right now. I just said, "They have gone. Let's start a new chapter." And everything have happened. People have died, but what can we do? There's nothing we can do. So it's only to come back like the way you used to be together, Dinka and Nuer.
But can all South Sudanese be as magnanimous, as forgiving, as Kerr?
Some of the citizens or some of the residents of Jonglei, they are not fine about it, but some, they are fine. They say, let it go. Let's look for a new plan. I've seen our economy have gone down and people are suffering.
Despite the social and economic devastation brought by the war, Kerr believes that nothing can take South Sudan backward. Indeed, he sees brighter days ahead.
I hope that some years to come, South Sudan to be a proud nation. And I consider us a country that is best in the world, South Sudan, despite that issues of the war. But if there's no war, everything is so far.
As brave as his trip across the river was, Kerr's forgive and forget stance may even require more courage, given the understandable hatred lingering after the war. If South Sudan is to heal, it will rely on the goodwill and forgiveness of Mabankur and thousands of others like him. Reporting from Juba, South Sudan, I'm Stephen Youngblood.
So that just about wraps up our inaugural edition of Peace Journalism Perspective. On our next show in March, we'll take a look at peace journalism projects in the West African country of Sierra Leone, and we'll also take a look at a special peace journalism fellowship being developed by the Center for Global Peace Journalism. Until then, I'm Steve Youngblood. Peace out.
Peace Journalism Perspectives is a production of the Center for Global Peace Journalism at Park University in Parkville, Missouri. The program is produced and hosted by the director of the center, Stephen Youngblood. I'm Logan Freeman, your announcer. Podcasts of Peace Journalism Perspectives are available at kkfi.org. For more information about peace journalism, visit the Center for Global Peace Journalism's website at park.edu/peacecenter. Thanks for listening. See you next time.